guest today is Dr. Thomas Wadden, a professor of psychology at Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Penn, and a principal investigator in the STEP program, which is a series of clinical trials funded by Novo Nordisk examining subcutaneous semaglutide for inducing weight loss in patients who are obese or overweight. In our discussion, we review the results of both STEP 1 and STEP 3, hypothesize where the alternative dosage of semaglutide could fit into treatment algorithms based on available data, and who should ultimately be responsible for prescribing a weight loss therapy to patients. It should be mentioned, this interview was recorded before the release of STEP 2 results, and that was therefore not included in this discussion. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Wadden.
Sure. I'm Tom Wadden. I'm a professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And I devote my research efforts to improving the treatment of obesity, looking at methods that include diet and physical activity, sometimes called lifestyle modification. And then I've been very interested in combining medications for weight loss with diet and physical activity. And finally, I'm very interested in the treatment of obesity by bariatric surgery as well.
Thank you for that brief introduction. And now for our guests that are listening, we'll be talking about the Step 1 and Step 3 studies today. This interview is being recorded in late February for those who may be listening down the road a bit. But these studies just came out, and now just right off the bat, Dr. Wadden, what were the most significant findings in your opinions from these two studies respectively?
Well, both of these studies, Step 1 and Step 3, showed that patients with overweight or obesity who received semaglutide 2.4 milligrams once daily, they lost 15 to 16% of their initial body weight. And that is a weight loss that is about twice the size of most FDA-approved medications. And it's also a weight loss that is well twice the size of most behavioral interventions for obesity. As striking as the mean results are, is the finding that in both studies, somewhere in the neighborhood of about 75% of patients lost 10% of their body weight. And again, about in the Step 3 trial, 56% of patients lost 15% of body weight. And again, that's something that you don't see with most currently approved weight loss medications, and you don't see it with diet and exercise interventions. So these are larger weight losses. They're going to deliver greater improvements in obesity-related health complications, including hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and sleep apnea. There are also larger weight losses that are going to be far more satisfying to patients with overweight and obesity, who typically want to lose about 20% of their starting weight and have been frustrated that with current medications and behavioral interventions, they can only lose about 5 to 10%. So it's a big step forward in terms of producing greater weight loss.
Thank you for that. And now I know when just looking at sort of the top line results of both of these studies, we saw about a 10 percentage point difference in Step 3 and about a 12 percentage point difference in Step 1 when looking at the overall weight loss between these two groups. Now, can you take me a little bit through what the differences in procedures were for both of these studies? I understand Step 3 was a bit more intense for patients. Can you sort of bring me through that?
Sure. So if we look at the Step 3 trial, the question we posed there was, if we give patients a rigorous behavioral weight loss intervention, how much additional weight loss will semaglutide add on top of that? So a high intensity intervention from a behavioral standpoint is at least 14 or more treatment sessions during the first 6 months. And in Step 3, patients got 19 treatment visits during the first 24 weeks. And in addition, for the first 8 weeks, they got 1,000 to 1,200 calorie a day meal replacement, which was comprised of liquid shakes, meal bars, and then prepared entrees. So we gave them that intervention to try to really jumpstart their weight loss during those first 8 weeks, and then additionally gave them all that intensive behavioral therapy known as IBT. And then after that, patients were seen approximately monthly to help facilitate the maintenance of weight loss. The finding during the first 24 weeks is that the patients who got IBT with placebo lost 8% of their weight, which is what we'd expect them to do if they're coming into a clinic just getting behavioral treatment, about an 8 to 10% weight loss. And then the question was, how much additional weight loss does semaglutide add on top of that? And it added about 10% more. So at the end of 68 weeks, the patients who got just the behavioral treatment with placebo, they actually regained a little bit of weight. So they ended up with a 5.7% weight loss. Those on semaglutide, by contrast, lost about 16% at their nadir and came close to keeping off the full 16%. So it was a 10.2 percentage point difference between the two groups in terms of difference in weight loss. We had thought potentially we would see a larger final weight loss with semaglutide plus IBT. We thought it might be as much as 18% of weight. Because in step one, if you want to talk about that trial now, in step one, patients were given a more moderate dose of lifestyle counseling. So they got essentially monthly meetings with a registered dietitian who encouraged them to reduce their calorie intake by 500 calories a day and to gradually increase their physical activity to 150 minutes. But it was only monthly meetings. And so this was a total of 18 visits over 68 weeks. And those patients in that study who got placebo lost just about 2.5% of their body weight. But the patients who received semaglutide added to that moderate intensity lifestyle intervention lost 15% of their weight. So semaglutide increased weight loss in that study by 12.5 percentage points. So we had thought maybe in step three, semaglutide would add an additional 12.5% of weight on over whatever the patients who got IBT plus placebo did. And we came, you know, close. We got a 16% loss, but we thought it might be as high as 18%. What that suggests is that for most people, you can probably reduce body weight by about 15% of starting weight. And once you reach that, the average person, because of biological counter-regulatory mechanisms, probably is not going to lose more weight. Now, clearly, we did have in both these studies about a third of patients who lost 20%. So there are people who are major responders to the drug who will do better, but on average, it's about a 15% reduction. So what we finally concluded in looking at the data is it seemed that the meal replacement we used in step three and all the intensive behavioral therapy sped up weight loss during the 24-week period, the first 24 weeks, because it did. The patients who got semaglutide in step three lost more weight during the first 24 weeks than did the patients who got semaglutide in step one. So it was a faster rate of weight loss. But the ultimate destination for patients who got semaglutide was pretty much the same, 15 to 16% of weight. So the study really does raise questions about, do you need intensive behavioral therapy to get a 15% weight loss with semaglutide? And the answer, without doing a head-to-head comparison, the answer seems to be, you probably don't. Probably more moderate intensity counseling is sufficient because the drug by itself seems like it's going to reset your body weight set point down about 15%.
Well, that's actually pretty fantastic when you really think about it, because I'm sure, you know, as a psychologist, when you start using terms like intensity with patients, it does raise some red flags. And now when we look at these trials, the big issue that stands out in terms of adverse events is this gastrointestinal adverse event rate. And this isn't specific to semaglutide as a GLP-1. It's sort of broadly across the class. Mm-hmm. How much concern would you have when, let's say, a patient was looking to address their obesity? How concerned would you be with the issues associated with gastrointestinal events as compared to some of the other issues you may have with other weight loss mediums, such as bariatric surgery or other avenues?
Yeah. You know, I think if you tell patients that there are going to be some GI side effects, and prepare them for them, they can cope with them very well. In addition, you gradually increase the dose of the drug just to control the GI reactions. And so patients start on 0.25 milligrams per week for an entire month, and then they escalate to 0.5 milligrams. Then the next month, they go to 1.0 milligrams. And so with that, you really can mitigate some of the nausea, some of the vomiting. Nausea is the primary thing. Most patients will report that their nausea has remitted in a period of week to 2 weeks and is not going to prevent them from staying on the drug. Certainly, there are some individuals who discontinue the medication. I think about 3% who discontinue. But the great majority of people say, yeah, I felt a little discomfort, but was able to continue. And it's also important to realize that not all patients do experience nausea or vomiting or diarrhea, these GI events. For nausea, it's about 43% experience it. So half are not going to, probably because of the titration. So to return you to your question, am I concerned about these side effects as compared to the side effects of other medications? These side effects are very manageable. Compared to bariatric surgery, this is a whole lot less invasive for the patient and is going to have far fewer side effects than bariatric surgery is going to have, certainly in the short term, you know, during the first year when patients are adjusting to their new smaller pouch and they're having trouble figuring out how much food they can eat without regurgitating food and the like. So this is a very tolerable therapy.
All right. And now I have to ask, is there anything else that you would like to see addressed within the STEP program before you would feel comfortable recommending an agent like semaglutide for weight loss specifically? Or do you think that these two studies have answered the majority of the questions surrounding?
Well, I think there are a couple of important questions left to answer about the STEP program, and these data will be forthcoming. One is, can patients maintain these large weight losses if they stay on the medication long-term? So we have great weight losses at 68 weeks. If patients continue to take the drug at 2 years and 3 years, are they going to be able to sustain the weight loss? I have every reason to think they will, based upon prior three-year data that we've seen with the liraglutide 3.0 and the liraglutide 1.2, 1.8. Which are similar to semaglutide. So the first thing is there durability to the weight loss? And I think that there will be. There is another STEP paper coming out which shows that once patients have lost weight with the drug and you withdraw the drug, that patients do regain weight. And I think that's an important message. These medications, and particularly semaglutide, are going to be intended for long-term use. You would not take a statin for 6 months or a year, and then feel like, yep, my cholesterol is fine. I'm going to stop the statin. You know your cholesterol will probably return toward baseline once you stopped it. The same is true with weight loss medications. They need to be taken long-term and definitely to manage what is a chronic problem for most people. So that's the first thing. Do they have a long-term weight management? The second thing is that you'd want to see that this medication is safe from a cardiovascular standpoint. So the manufacturer, which is Novo Nordisk, is currently doing a large trial of 17,000 participants to see if semaglutide 2.4 not only is safe, but reduces major adverse cardiovascular events. So does it reduce the occurrence of fatal as well as non-fatal heart attack and stroke? And in previous trials of both liraglutide and semaglutide 1.0, which is approved for the treatment of type 2 diabetes already, Novo Nordisk has found that their medications do reduce both fatal and non-fatal adverse events, a composite. So I think that will really be the linchpin to show that not only do you get these fabulous weight losses, you can maintain them, but you actually do reduce cardiovascular outcomes. I think that'll get a lot of attention for these medications, and we'll finally get attention for obesity. that if you can treat obesity effectively, you can have a big impact on cardiovascular events and probably all-cause mortality.
I think that really segues nicely into my next question for you, which would be, what sort of treatment gap would this medication fill if it were to be approved for obesity management? We know GLP-1s naturally have this effect on HbA1c. So you would imagine that as it's treating obesity, it's also sort of reverting pre-diabetes back to normoglycemia for a lot of patients. What kind of gap, especially with the rising obesity rates, would this fill if it were approved for treatment of obesity?
Yeah. So this is going to be a terrific bridge from what we have now with behavioral treatment, which produces a 5 to 8% weight loss. It gives you somewhat better control of your diabetes. If you have diabetes, it can help you prevent diabetes. But you really do want more weight loss. The larger the weight loss, the greater the improvements in the obesity-related health complications, including hypertension, diabetes, and sleep apnea, fatty liver disease. So everything is going to get better with greater weight loss. So I'm particularly interested to see how this drug will do in improving sleep apnea, because right now we know that if you can get a weight loss of 10%, you can have a big impact on the apnea hypopnea index in terms of bringing it down. Less than 10%, you don't see much action on it. And I think we're really going to be looking at, well, can you use this medication in some people to get a weight loss of 20% or more of body weight? That potentially would be as effective for some people as getting bariatric surgery. Bariatric surgery is by far the most effective treatment we have for obesity. Sleeve gastrectomy, when essentially you're removing about 3/4 of the stomach, is a very safe procedure. It is effective in helping to produce remission of type 2 diabetes in about 25 to 30% of people at 1 to 3 years. And it's possible that this new medication is going to be able to have similar effects in patients with type 2 diabetes, big weight loss and remission of type 2 diabetes. I wouldn't be surprised if we'll see some head-to-head comparisons of those approaches in the coming years, just to see that.
Definitely. I think even before we learn more about the STEP or the results of the STEP program, there was already a discussion between ways to sort of achieve the weight loss achieved by bariatric surgery through sort of less aggressive methods. And this sounds like we could be on that path very soon. And now I have to ask you, I know you're a psychologist, but do you think that there's any specific mechanistic differences between the way this semaglutide dosage works compared to, say, an increased or modified dosage of another GLP-1? Do you think we could see this from other agents, like we saw with the onslaught of heart failure benefits among SGLT2s? Or is this specific to semaglutide, do you think?
No, I think you're going to see similar agents, which are GLP-1s, potentially combined with other agents, including things like amylin, which is another naturally occurring hormone in the body. So I think you're going to see a lot of activity in the GLP-1 space and combining it with other hormones, naturally occurring hormones. So it's exciting that there's going to be so much activity going on. Several companies have things they're working on right now. It's a pretty robust pipeline. And the exciting thing for me is that these are really rationally derived therapies. Previously, in the history of weight loss medications, the weight loss medications have been discovered fortuitously. You know, we gave people topiramate for seizures. And it turned out when they're taking this drug for seizures and epilepsy, that all of a sudden they started losing weight. And so then, okay, well, let's make that a weight loss drug. We didn't really know the mechanisms of action, but there was weight loss. And similarly, with bupropion, which was developed for depression, and then secondarily for smoking cessation, people lost some weight. Okay, well, let's put that together with another drug and we'll make that a weight loss drug. But those were fortuitous, unexpected consequences. With these GLP-1 agents, we realized that, GLP-1 is released after people eat, and it is traveling to the the pancreas to increase insulin secretion. It's also traveling to the brain to stimulate receptors that cause you to feel fuller and cause you to stop eating. And so what they've done is to take these naturally occurring hormones and synthesize them and provide larger doses of them. But I have a lot more comfort knowing the mechanisms of action as compared to medications that we haven't known about.
All right, thank you for that. And now just lastly, before I let you go, there's, especially in the field of sort of cardiometabolic diseases, there's a lot of debate over who should be prescribing what type of agents to patients. In a perfect world, let's say that this does receive approval for the treatment of obesity, which clinicians do you think should be prescribing this agent to patients? Should it be a primary care? Should it be an endocrinologist? Should it be a cardiologist? Ideally, all three would feel comfortable, but who do you think this responsibility will fall onto once it becomes approved?
It's a really important question about who's going to be best prepared to prescribe these medications and to provide whatever support is needed with them. And these medications potentially are so robust that you don't need as much diet counseling, but you would still want to encourage people to engage and increase physical activity because of the benefits that exercise has upon cardiovascular health. So I would hope that whoever is prescribing the medications is going to certainly promote the importance of a healthy lifestyle efforts in addition to taking the drug. To answer your question, I think that endocrinologists will be very comfortable with the drug since they've been using these medications to treat patients with type 2 diabetes. I think that eventually primary care practitioners will be very comfortable with them well. They'll see that they can control the side effects if they titrate the drug up slowly. So just as a psychologist and with my psychiatric colleagues, we think we know best how to think about use of antidepressants. But who's the number one prescriber of antidepressants? It's primary care physicians because they have the greatest contact with patients. So I think it's likely that primary care physicians will be prescribing this medication quite frequently and just by their greater numbers, more so than endocrinologists. I hope that cardiologists will be interested in the drug and using it to decrease the risk of cardiovascular events. I would think that's going to be the case. Nurse practitioners who are more concerned about providing comprehensive lifestyle counseling may also be a group that gets engaged with the use of these medications.
All right, thank you. That was
and finally, I do think bariatric surgeons will be interested in semaglutide and GLP-1 agents. Bariatric surgery, as we talked about, is by far the most effective therapy. But about 10 to 20% of patients who receive bariatric surgery either don't lose adequate weight, that they lose less than 15% of their weight the first year. And then you've got a proportion of patients, 10 to 15% maybe, who regain substantial amounts of weight after 2 to 3 years. And it's possible these GLP-1 agents could be added to those patients to restore them to their larger weight loss, or to help them achieve a larger weight loss than they did the first year. So I think bariatric surgeons will be interested in these agents.
That's it for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook. For the latest in endocrine news, be sure to head to endocrinologynetwork.com and subscribe to our free e-newsletters. Thank you for listening.